I've said a thing or two. I think of lying in bed. I shouldn't have said, but there it is. You see, it's all clear. You are meant to be here. And I was born into stories. Stories about the value of work and the right way to live. Stories about God and country, about community, loyalty, steadfastness, and resolve. Stories about the role and place of humans on this planet. Stories about our relationship to something we called nature. I was born into stories. Nobody told me these stories. They didn't have to. The stories were the air I breathed, the water in which I swam, the ground upon which I walked. They were all around me. We didn't even know there were stories. We just thought they were the way things are. My world was a playground. There were fish to catch, boats to row, parades to watch, trails to hike, lakes to swim, snowmobiles to ride, games to play, presents to open, and family to share it all with. The days would end with sunsets and fireworks, and sometimes I would dance until I collapsed with joy. It was a magical land, cherry popsicles and warm milk, birthday cakes and store-bought costumes and brand new chairs under the tree. A land of giant geese, well-dressed poodles, talented birds, and even more talented people. The earth was our merry-go-round, our monkey bars, our swing set. As long as we didn't look down, everything would be just fine. I was born halfway up the population explosion. I was born on the slope of rising CO2 levels. I was born in the foothills of a mass extinction. I was born on the rocky rise of oil production. I was born facing forward, looking ever upward, my first step, a step up slope, a step into progress, a step into a vast and glorious human future. We were moving on up. There was no looking back. There was a mountain to conquer, and conquer it we would. All we had to do was climb a bit further. But the mountain we were climbing was not what we thought it was. Rather than rising from natural forces, the slopes up which we were headed were the results of imbalance and short-sightedness. In our efforts to progress, to succeed, to improve, to strive, to overcome, to manage, to shape, to solve, and to grow, we wielded huge new forces across the globe. We walked as giants upon the earth, unaware of the footprints we left behind. I have walked that path, unaware of my own big feet, enacting the stories of our culture, not stopping long enough to feel the instability of the slope underfoot.
You know, it's sort of inevitable. I mean, to some extent, there is no good plan, I would say. There are just too many people. There is going to be a die-off. You know, the population of the Earth is three times the size it can be sustainably. And so whether these people die because they made the wrong real estate buying decisions or for some other reason, you know, in the grand scheme of things, probably doesn't really matter. You know, there's just a lot of talk about real estate and mortgages and savings and credit and you know, these issues and retirement and issues of economics, all money-related stuff. Now, the important thing to keep in mind is, you know, this is probably all going to collapse. It's all going to go away. When that happens, money will become completely irrelevant. And not only that, but even like various types of precious commodities will be really hard to trade. Like the entire financial infrastructure, you know, is basically something that exists for a while and eventually won't. And so really people should think about far more important things than money, and not spend too much time obsessing about questions of money. It's just something that, you know, I want to get out there, because so much time is devoted to something so ephemeral. It seems like, first of all, it's boring, and secondly, it seems like a waste of time.
Collapse. The apparent reason is often social strife. Either within a formally cohesive social group or actual open warfare with an external enemy. But all complex urbanized societies are ultimately dependent upon agriculture. This agricultural base is in turn dependent on the ecological health of the home environment, especially on fertile soil and adequate water. Thus, the ultimate cause of collapse is often the deterioration of the ecosystems that feed the human societies.
All the structures that now exist, our urban formations, our transportation systems, our means of getting food, globalization as an economic model, capitalism as an economic model, which depends upon constant expansion and growth and ever more resources, it cannot possibly continue to exist, because they're all based on the root base of all of it is the existence of cheap energy.
In order to avoid a deflationary depression, we have to have continual growth in the money supply, which has to be based on continual growth in economic activity, which must be based on the continual growth in available energy and raw materials. We've built an economy based on the idea that it has to grow every year or else collapse. So soon the economy won't be able to grow, and all signs are that we may be facing a kind of global economic collapse because of peak oil.
Thank you. the shuffling madness of the locomotive breath. Runs the all-time loser headlong to his death. Oh, it feels a piston scraping, steam breaking on his brow. Sees his children jumping off the stations one by one. His woman and his best friend in bed and having fun. Oh, it's calling down the corridor on his hands and knees. Old Charlie stole the handle and the train and won't stop going. No way to slow.
Although no one in Washington is telling you, Americans have been getting poorer and poorer since the late 1970s. The reasons are that global oil discovery peaked in 1962, American oil production peaked in 1970, and our population keeps rising. Only three tactics can mitigate this ongoing process. Number 1. Take energy resources by military force. We did this in Iraq. Number 2. Give up America's unique style of dog-eat-dog capitalism in favor of a new political system. Number 3. Reduce population at least as fast as available energy resources fall. Americans waste more natural resources than any other people in the history of the world. Although we are the same animal that evolved to need 3,000 or 4,000 calories a day, the average American uses over 200,000 calories of total energy a day. Americans have been getting poorer and poorer since the late 1970s. Conservation, efficiency, and alternatives cannot solve the problem. The Earth is a sphere. All spheres are finite. Therefore, the Earth is finite. The Earth's energy resources are finite too. Finite stocks such as oil, coal, and uranium, and finite flows such as wind and solar. It is physically impossible to increase these finite resources. We mine minerals and fossil fuels from the Earth's crust. The deeper we dig, the greater the energy requirements. The most concentrated and most accessible resources are produced first. Thereafter, more and more energy is required to produce poorer and poorer quality resources. This means that energy companies must spend more energy tomorrow to produce the same amount of energy as they did today. As time goes on, a larger and larger fraction of the energy produced must be reinvested in energy production to keep the same level of energy available for consumer goods and services. The laws of thermodynamics tell us that no matter what anyone does, the energy cost of energy will continue to rise for many decades. As the energy cost of energy continues to rise, the fraction of every dollar consumed by energy costs will also rise. Since Americans consume more energy per capita than anyone else, rising energy costs will ultimately make our products uncompetitive in the global marketplace. At that point, America's economic machine is out of gas. Forever. Available natural resources are declining, but the population of the United States continues to rise. This means that fewer and fewer natural resources are available for each American citizen. It's impossible to increase the finite amount of natural resources, but if population numbers fall faster than available energy, then each may have a greater portion of what's left.
An example of societal collapse is the Polynesian culture that arose on Easter Island. A smallish island, 66 square miles in size, perched by itself in the South Pacific, 2,300 miles from Chile and 1,300 miles from the nearest neighboring island group. Easter Island was discovered by Polynesian seafarers intent on colonizing new land in approximately 700 AD. The estimated 20 to 30 colonists that found the island had brought with them the resources necessary to establish a community, including chickens, sweet potatoes, yams, taro, banana, and coconut. Of these foods, only sweet potato thrived in the subtropical environment. Thus, sweet potatoes and chickens became the foundation of their diet. Over time, their population increased and a number of separate villages emerged across the island. Initially, competition between the villages seemed to have taken the form of monument building. From as early as 800 AD, villages began to erect stone platforms known as ahus, with large human statues on them called moai. They may have been monuments to living or dead local leaders, as some of the monuments contained tombs. As these societies grew, religious and political hierarchies developed. Over time, there became an elite class that was supported by the farmers. By 1500, the population reached an estimated 15,000 people, and the size of the elite class and the number of stone statues both continued to grow. All of these factors increased the pressure on both the land and the laborers to produce even more food. Forested areas were continually cleared to make land available for agriculture. A total of 900 stone statues have been found on the island, the largest of them 70 feet tall and weighing 270 tons. All of the statues were carved out of basalt at one location on the island and then transported to sites all along the 30-mile coastline. This was accomplished by a large group of laborers dragging the moai over dirt roadways on wooden rollers made by felling trees in the subtropical forest that originally covered the entire island. By 1700, the island was completely deforested.
The last one. Well, they'd made up their minds to be everywhere, because why not? Everywhere was theirs because they thought so. They with two leaves, they whom the birds despise. In the middle of stones, they made up their minds. They started to cut. Well, they cut everything because why not? Everything was theirs because they thought so. It fell into its shadows and they took both away. Some to have, some for burning. Well, cutting everything, they came to the water. They came to the end of the day. There was one left standing. They would cut it tomorrow. They went away. The night gathered in the last branches. The shadow of the night gathered in the shadow on the water. The night and the shadow put on the same head. And it said, "Nah." Well, in the morning, they cut the last one. Like the others, the last one fell into its shadow. It fell into its shadow on the water. They took it away, its shadow stayed on the water. Well, they shrugged, they started trying to get the shadow away. They cut right to the ground, the shadow stayed whole. They laid boards on it, the shadow came out on top. They shone lights on it, the shadow got blacker and clearer. They exploded the water, the shadow rocked. They built a huge fire on the roots. They sent up black smoke between the shadow and the sun. The new shadow flowed without changing the old one. They shrugged, they went away to get stones. They came back, the shadow was growing. They started setting up stones, it was growing. They looked the other way, it went on growing. They decided they would make a stone. They took stones to the water, they poured them into the shadow. They poured them in, the stones vanished. The shadow was not filled, it went on growing. That was one day. The next day was just the same, it went on growing. They did all the same things, it was just the same. They decided to take its water from under it. They took away water, they took it away, the water went down. The shadow stayed where it was before. It went on growing, it grew onto the land. They started to scrape the shadow with machines. When it touched the machines, it stayed on them. They started to beat the shadow with sticks. where it touched the sticks and stayed on them. They started to beat the shadow with hands. Where it touched the hands, it stayed on them. That was another day. Well, the next day started about the same. It went on growing. They pushed lights into the shadow. Where the shadow got onto them, they went out. They began to stomp on the edge and got their feet. And when it got their feet, they fell down. It got into eyes. The eyes went blind. The ones that fell down, it grew over and they vanished. The ones that went blind and walked into it vanished. The ones that could see and stood still and swallowed their shadow. And it swallowed them too and they vanished. Well, the others ran. The ones that were left went away to live if it would let them. They went as far as they could, the lucky ones.
Initially, progressive deforestation would have led to an increase in farmable land and food production, and therefore to an increase in the human population on the island. But over time, the lack of forest cover caused soil erosion, decreasing crop yields, which resulted in a reduced carrying capacity overall. The absence of trees meant the islanders could no longer build seaworthy boats to catch fish and dolphins. Until that point, being a primary source of protein for the population. Competition for ever scarcer resources increased, warfare and famine became commonplace, and the complex society on Easter Island collapsed. The last moi were erected in about 1620, and by 1680, rival clan factions were pulling them down. When the first European ship encountered the island in 1722, there were an estimated 2,000 islanders left alive, living in defensible caves and surviving on cannibalism. The formerly complex culture had disintegrated so thoroughly that survivors on the island had no idea of the significance of the statues, or in fact who had built them. The apparent cause of collapse on Easter Island was overshoot of the carrying capacities of the ecosystem, and the resulting environmental damage to that system, which then reduced the carrying capacity and exacerbated the condition of overshoot.
How will we face into the issue of human population? I went to speak with William Catton, a professor of sociology and human ecology at Washington State University, now retired, and author of an amazing book on ecology and human population called Overshoot. According to Catton's assessment of the carrying capacity of the planet,
I think the way we're living now, the world was overpopulated already by the time of our Civil War.
The population at the time of the U.S. Civil War was just over 1 billion, so we've now overshot that number by more than
5 billion, as Catton told me.
It is possible to exceed carrying capacity, but only temporarily. If you exceed carrying capacity, you then damage the environment upon which you're depending.
Looking closely, I've come to see that population numbers for humans, in and of themselves, are only part of the story. As Catton points out, it's the damage those numbers do that counts, and that damage is intimately connected to our way of life. The Earth supports as great a collective mass of ants as it does people. It can do so because ants aren't building 6,000 square foot homes, driving 2 hours to their jobs, buying plasma TV sets, and killing each other with depleted uranium munitions.
We in the developed world have 32 times the footprint on the planet on resources depletion. 32 times the person in India. I think we all know that, though the figure is stunning. And it ought to make us really think and start to talk with each other about this.
You talk about how many energy slaves per capita do we have. In this country, we've got something like 70 times as many energy slaves per capita as people in Bangladesh. Instead of thinking of that Bangladesh as the overpopulated country, if you multiply each of us by 70, take that 290 million or whatever number of us there are now, multiply it by 70, wow, we are an overpopulated country.
In those terms, the U.S. is a nation of 21 billion people, and my own three children add 210 to that number. To speak of population, then, as the root cause of our problem makes little sense to me. It conjures images of crowded third world cities and teeming masses of human flesh, while the global impacts of rich first world lifestyles go unexamined. Big feet, more and more feet, and more feet getting bigger and bigger. And if these feet just keep on walking, one of these days they're going to walk right into oblivion. It cannot be sustained for much longer. There are any number of catastrophic forces that could lower our numbers as oil depletion, climate change, and environmental collapses play out. One thing large populations are especially prone to is disease.
Microbes are going to have a lot more to do with it than humans have to do with it in the end. And nature, and we're still governed by natural rules, we don't like to think we're not, but we are. When you put together the kind of biomass that humans represent on this planet, we're an asset to somebody. We're a resource.
Send me a-
it's really so sad. You know, you look at, and particularly American culture is emblematic of this. You go to a typical shopping mall and look at the people around you and the environment around you. And the utter shallowness and hopelessness of it all is profoundly depressing.
Really don't mind if you sit this one out. My words but a whisper, your deafness a shout. I may make you feel that I can't make you think. Your sperm's in the gutter, your love's in the sink. So you ride yourselves over the fields, and you make all your animal deals, and your wise men don't know how it feels to be thick as a brick.
Somehow we've got to devise a way for obtaining a soft landing as we reduce the population from 6+ billion down toward 1 billion. If we decide we want to reduce it, we can see to it that the reduction occurs in a more humane way than it will occur if we just try to keep on business as usual.
Humanity's never been in this. This is new. This is new. And this is big. And this is not being talked about.
And because it is not being talked about, we have no clear idea how we might devise that softer landing. Talking about it, then, clearly and honestly, is the first step. Without that, catastrophe is inevitable. But either way,
our global population is going to be reduced.
This is what I had to face. The population of my species is going to be reduced. I had to face it just like the grizzly bears have had to face it, and the wild salmon have had to face it, just like the right whales and the piping plovers and the mountain gorillas have had to face it. Just like the great auks and the golden toads and the black-fin ciscos had to face it before they went extinct. And I had to face something else. I have a choice about how I meet it. My friend Lyle gave it some perspective.
The fact is that there have been die-offs of civilization. There have been collapses of great, mighty civilizations. Sophisticated, powerful, unbelievable civilizations have collapsed. And it's a choice. It's a choice that we can decide to succeed or fail, and I'm going to go ahead and decide to succeed, thank you, and I'd really like it if you'd come with me.
What choices do we now have? What would that success Lyle speaks of look like? What is inevitable at this point? And what remains to be created if only we awaken to our power? Most importantly, why have we not already awakened?
Thank you. home bleeding, nation bleeding, still more bleeding. Life is funny, skies are sunny, bees made honey.
Another classic example of the overshoot of carrying capacity in the annals of biology is the story of caribou on St. Matthew's Island, which is off the coast of Alaska and similar in size to Easter Island. During World War II in 1944, the U.S. Coast Guard installed a navigation station and placed 19 men on the previously uninhabited island. Later that year, the Coast Guard released 29 caribou on the island as a backup food source. These animals landed in caribou paradise, as lichen is the primary food for this species, and lichen mats 4 inches thick carpeted the island. The men of the Coast Guard station were the caribou's only potential predators, but the war ended in 1945, and the men left before they had the chance to shoot any of the animals, and the caribou were left alone to be fruitful and multiply. A biologist visited the island in 1963 and found it overrun with caribou. He estimated there were 6,000 of them. The island ecosystem was seriously degraded, with the lichen mats eaten to the ground and plants heavily grazed and browsed. When the biologist returned again in 1966, he found the island covered with the skeletons of caribou. They counted only 42 live animals, 41 females, and one male with abnormal antlers that probably wasn't able to reproduce. The population had crashed by 99%. By the mid-1980s, the caribou of St. Matthew Island died out completely. This unintended experiment in population dynamics and range ecology ended up as it began, with winds howling over a place devoid of any large mammals. As on Easter Island, the apparent causes of the collapse on St. Matthew's Island were, one, overshooting carrying capacity, and two, environmental damage, which reduced the initial carrying capacity.
They did eat every herb of the land and all the fruit of the trees, and there remained not any green thing.
The situation is desperate. It's the worldwide eco slam, where climate crash goes head to head with the peak oil kid and overshoot tears into mass extinction. It's the smackdown at the end of the universe, and tickets go on sale this Friday. The American lifestyle is unsustainable. That means that it can't be sustained. It's coming to an end. Remember how 30 years ago we looked to the future and said, 30 years from now, if we don't act, we're going to be in trouble? Well, it's now, and we are, because we didn't. The fundamental laws of life have been broken. The consequences of that are now apparent. Remember the secret plan. The dominant culture is not going to stop until it destroys everything. It can't. It's built on a foundation of faulty assumptions. I see no way that it can be reformed. It can only be discarded so that something new can grow in its place.
Caps are melting, you can measure the rise of the poisoned oceans, hear all the lies of the political pundits and corporate crooks, their accountants and scientists cooking the books with hardly an inkling of what it's about. Wedded to profit in flood and in drought, I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. Here on the bayou, amidst mountains of soil, washed up farmland covered in oil, 1 ton every acre, lost every year, and along with the pesticides, it ends up right here. Millions of miles of chemical wheat, challenging all to try to compete and leave waste to your country like we've done to ours. Let them eat coffee, sugar, coca, and flowers. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. Here in the city, shrouded in smoke, 10 million people this morning awoke to a future of cancer, industrial disease. So let's build some more suburbs and buy SUVs. Cut down the mountains, burn all the coal, and put all the money in a humongous bowl. They'll call it progress and they'll blame it on you to end life as we know it, to enrich the few. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. Yes, I speak to you now from an occupied place. You might call it your home or a terrorist base. They'll send your sons and your daughters to make sure that it's theirs, while they sit in their mansions in plush leather chairs. And everyone's waiting for us to decide. In dust we were born, and in dust we reside. Will we realize the commons is to shepherd and share? Here in this war zone called land, water, and air, I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world.
As civilization has provided more and more for us, it's made us more and more infantile, so that we are less and less able to think for ourselves, less and less able to provide for ourselves, and this makes us more of a herd. We develop more of a herd mentality, where we take our cues from the people around us, from the authority figures around us.
Central to my understanding of the world is this: all cultures are based on stories. The culture of civilization and empire comes with its own unique set of beliefs and impulses. Listen to some of the stories that have brought us to our present predicament.
There's never quite enough.
We're innately flawed.
It's heresy today to say, let's stop growing.
Hard work is morally virtuous.
More is better.
The physical world as I see it is everything.
We can solve any problem.
And they actually say that the way to be happy is to own more stuff.
We are to subdue the earth and have dominion over it.
We own. We own the planet. We own everything here. We own these resources.
Humans have rights, and nothing else have rights.
There are many times in which people just don't want to be told that such and such a place is off limits to them.
Living with stories like this, is it any wonder we're devouring the planet?
In some ways, we're in a culture of two-year-olds, where we just won't look at the limits.
Dominion over the earth in Genesis didn't mean to leave this pillaged and smoking.
Daniel Quinn has named some of the basic stories of empire.
The ambient voice of our culture tells us that this is the best that humans could ever hope for. What we've got right now, where we're going, is just unsurpassable. Ergo, any alternative has got to be worse. There were other civilizations besides ours. They did not think that they had the one right way to live, and that everyone in the world should be made to live that way. We are taught to think that we are humanity. If there are other people out there that were different from us, well, and they're degenerates, or they're just not as far advanced as we are, we came along and began doing things and building civilization. And this is the way humans were meant to live from the beginning, which is one reason why we can't give it up.
There is a new story arising in the world, the story of the Great Turning, the turning away from a culture of domination and death, and the turning toward a culture that is life-sustaining and life-renewing. All over the planet, People are now telling this story. The Buddhist scholar and deep ecologist Joanna Macy tells this story in her workshops. The writer and activist David Corton tells it in his book by the same name. It's a story to be told by our descendants, looking back on this present time. Will we be the monsters of our great-grandchildren's nightmares? Or will we walk, as the story of the Great Turning says, as heroes and healers in the epic poetry of those still unborn voices? Will we be reviled for our entitled destructive ways? Or will we be lovingly remembered in the songs of our descendants as they recount the story of this lost and very wounded tribe that stepped back from the abyss and found its way home to the community of living souls? We get to choose. Who are we going to be? It's time to be truthful. Millions of sensual, pulsing animal bodies are now living trapped and used and starved in cities and cubicles and sweatshops and food courts and traffic jams and suburbs and public school classrooms. People who are not rich and white already know this. What would happen if we let ourselves feel our feelings about all of this? The entire community of life on this planet is now being threatened. Where do we stick our picket pins? Where do we take a stand? When do we find the courage to let ourselves feel what is going on? Our feelings are the swiftest path back to our forgotten selves. It's time to be open and humble. There are huge forces at work in the world, both seen and unseen. It's time to ask for help. Ask the ancestors. Ask the gods. Ask your God. Go outside and lie down on the earth and ask the land and the sky and the life of this place. And then listen for a response. Listen to the voices of soil and stone, wind and water, the voices of cirrus clouds and chickadees, of red squirrels and wood beetles and Russian olives and hickories. The world will tell us what it knows. If only we will be still and listen. And then speak. It's time to show up in our own lives and tell the truth. It's time to talk about the world situation with everyone we see. We're all in this together. What a relief it'll be to discover that we are not alone. It's time to act with great intention. There is work aplenty to do in this weary world, and people engaged in that work. Find those people. Join in. Save rivers and stop bulldozers and stand up at city council meetings to tell your truth. Share skills, evolve local communities, move from agriculture to permaculture and grow your own food. Learn about medicinal herbs. As Derek Jensen says, we need it all. Find your work and do it. It's time. But what about that speeding train? How will the great turning turn? We can wait for the train to crash on its own and hope that it doesn't kill us and everything else. But with the children grown, perhaps we can come together and decide to dismantle, joyfully and with conscious intent, the rusty and dangerous old swing set of a culture that no longer serves us. This may seem an impossible task, but if the alternative is extinction, then we have nothing to lose. We humans once knew how to live on this planet. A few still do, and that's the good news. It can be done. We can do way, way better than empire.
so hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes, and true currents in thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees, strong ozone and safe sunshine. Good planets, what? Hard to find. Good planets are in demand. Clean beaches and sparkling sands, and the land masses, room to spare. That's good, yeah. Jet streams and perfect air. High forests and low wetlands are good planets are in demand. And the mind don't know, and the heart can't see. Let the blind man go to his destiny. Yeah. Good planets are rare indeed. Rain falling on crops and seed. Big rivers and good topsoil. Fuel sources from cane to oil. Green garden, all that we need. Good planets are rare indeed. Right. Let the blind